And hello, SunSouth listeners. This is Andy Bombick, which means, once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with the novel that I've been reading now for about 3 months, titled The Ballad of Darcy and Russell. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled Mashiki Road, The Seven Grandfather Teachings. And then it's I Know How to Draw an Owl, Alfie and His Dad, Brownie Groundhog and Their Wintry Surprise. And if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with Let's Go Swimming with Mr. Silly Pants. So it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled Mashiki Road, The Seven Grandfather Teachings. The kitchen was filled with the sweet scent of Grandma Mindy's fry bread. Lily and Ogma and their younger cousin Ellie were eating lunch together. Milgwich, said Ogma, it's my last one, I promise. Grandma Mindy smiled. Have as much as you want, my boy. After they finished eating, Grandma Mindy held up a handful of cheddar and another of sage. Of cedar and another of sage. She used these medicines during prayer. She also used them to cleanse the house. I'm running low on medicines, Grandma Mindy told them. I have only a little bit left. Can you three get more today? Ogma, Ellie, and Lily each found a container to hold the cedar and sage. They set off for Mashiki Road. It wasn't long before they found the path in the woods. They were on their way. Suddenly, Ellie stopped in her tracks. Makwi, she whispered. Up in the tree was the biggest black bear they had ever seen.
Don't be afraid, Bear said in a big, booming voice. I represent courage, one of the seven grandfather teachings. Even when you are afraid, it's important that you still find the courage to do what's right.
Lily spoke up. We need to find my grandma some medicines. May we pass? Bear nodded. His voice was low growl.
Of course. Have courage. Come to see me again someday. I get lonely in these trees by myself. Gigwabimum.
The three moved past Bear. They walked along the wooded path. It wasn't long before they spotted another visitor on Mashiki Road. Sabi slouched on a tree stump. His messy hair pointed in all directions. Ogma snickered. That's how Lily's hair looks in the morning. Lily rolled her eyes. No, it isn't. Let's go talk to him. Ellie was a little worried, but she decided to have courage. And he looks like Bigfoot. They approached Sabi together. Sabi spoke to them in a soft voice.
Bozohu, little ones, you've already met Bear, so you understand courage. I represent honesty.
Ellie spoke up. That's when you tell the truth. Just then, Ogama remembered something. I was honest when I told Grandma Mindy I was hungry today. Sabi nodded his approval. They said goodbye to Sabi and kept walking along the path. In the entrance of a clearing, they spotted a large, looming animal. Buffalo, Ellie cried, bouncing in excitement. She had never met a buffalo before. Come on, let's go see. She pulled Lily and Ogama forward. The great buffalo bowed his head in greeting.
Bozo, he said. Are you here for the medicines?
He was surrounded by sage plants. Yes, we are, Ogama said. He patted his bucket.
Remember to practice respect, especially when gathering medicines, Buffalo said. These are sacred plants. You should treat them with care.
The three thanked him. Migwich, Then they scattered into the clearing. First, they put out tobacco. Then they gathered enough sage for Grandma Mindy. They were careful to snap the sage stems and leave the roots in the ground. That way, the plants would grow back. They filled their bags halfway, leaving room for cedar. They walked through the clearing back into the woods. Suddenly, a creature stepped out from behind a tree. It was Wolf. He had a shiny gray coat and a long, flowing tail. His eyes sparkled. "Wow," Ogama said in awe. Wolf bowed his head. "Miigwech," he thanked him. "Come closer. I have something to tell you." "Another grandfather teaching?" Ogama whispered. Wolf spoke to them. "I represent humility. Having humility means not being too proud." Lily had never heard this word before. "Is it bad to be proud?" she asked. "Of course not," Wolf replied. "You can be proud and have humility. Instead of only cheering on yourself, you must cheer on other people too." Happy with Wolf's words, they said goodbye and kept moving along the path. Soon, Ellie pointed. "Look, a river," Ogama said. "That means we're getting close, right?" "I think so," Lily smiled. From alongside the river, they noticed a half-finished dam slowing down the water. On top of the dam was Beaver. He was working hard. Ellie was amazed. "Hey there, who are you?" she called out. "Bonjour," Beaver said. He climbed down to meet them. "I am Amek. I represent the grandfather teaching of wisdom," he told them. Lily pointed at the dam. "How did you do that?" she asked. Amek thought carefully. Then he said, "It is my wisdom, as a beaver, to know how to build a dam. We are all smart or wise in our own way. This is my way." He added, "I'm quite busy, though, so I'll be on my way. Gigwang Beeman." "Gigwang Beeman," they waved as he went back to his work. At the end of the path along the river was a small lake. They stopped to rest. "Only a little farther until we find the cedar, right?" Ogma asked. His stomach grumbled. Lily laughed. "Yes, we're almost there." Then something splashed in the water. They saw turtle on a lily pad.
"Ubunzu, what are you doing here?" Turtle said in a quiet, rumbling voice.
Lily held up her bag of sage. "We're collecting medicines for our grandma." Turtle waved to them. They got as close as they could without getting their feet wet.
"Yeah, I'm Turtle. I represent the grandfather teaching of truth," he told them.
Ogama thought of Sabi. "Is that the same as honesty?" Turtle shook his head slowly.
"No, we are much alike. But we are different. Being honest means to not lie. Truth is about being genuine to yourself and others."
They nodded in understanding. "Miigwech," Ellie called to Turtle as they moved along. They were close to the cedar grove. Finally, they found the cedar. First, they offered tobacco. Then they began to collect the medicine. They worked until they had plenty of cedar for Grandma. They carefully snapped the cedar off the tree, just like they did with the sage. Soon, their containers were nearly full. Grandma Mindy would have enough medicine for a long time. They were excited to return to her house. It was getting late, and Ogama was ready for dinner. As they began walking back, something swooped over their heads. "Whoa!" Ogama cried, nearly dropping his bucket. An eagle landed in front of them.
"Good job, you three," he said.
"Migzi?" Lily counted on her fingers. They had met 6 visitors so far. "Do you represent the last grandfather teaching?"
"Yes. I watched you meet all the others. I wanted to make sure your journey was safe. I represent the grandfather teaching of love. I'm showing you love by looking after you," Miigzi said. "It's time
to go home now. Lily, Ogma, and Ellie raced home with their full bags. They felt safe knowing Migzi was watching over them. Grandma Mindy waited for them on the porch. "Hurry up, would you?" she called from the top of the stairs. She smiled widely. "Coming," they said. Inside, Grandma Mindy inspected their bags. Lily handed her a few pieces of medicine. "Are these good?" she asked. Grandma looked at them. "Yes, these are perfect. Did you remember to offer your tobacco?" "Yes," Ellie said. After dinner, they sat with Grandma Mindy in the living room. They told her about everything they had seen. "Bear was so big," Ogma said. "Turtle was so small," Ellie told her. "Migzi watched out for us the whole time," Lily explained. Grandma Mindy listened with a smile. She was so glad to have them home again. "I know how to draw an owl. Today we're drawing owls," Ms. Rio said. "A round head and oval body, taloned feet, and a small hooked beak, folded wings, and two big eyes." "Oh," Miss Rio held up my owl for the class to see. "How did Bell make his eyes so wise?" Bell's owl almost looked alive. I shrugged and shook my head. "I know, but I don't want to tell." And it shows her walking to school. Leo's house is tall and white, and Annika's is green with roses and a barking puppy by the gate. The other kids run inside apartment buildings, short and tall. Mom and I once had our own home too, with a table and chairs and a sleepy cat. But now we live in our old blue car. One day we packed it high with clothes, Grandma's cups and pots and soap, and drove and drove. And it shows them in the car, now they're in a forest, until we came at last to a shady park. "The perfect place," Mom said, "when it gets dark." We washed our dishes, brushed our teeth, and snuggled under blanket heaps. "Sweet dreams," Mom said, and hugged me tight. The night got quiet, and the moon felt near. But in a strange new place, it's hard to sleep. "Hoo, hoo, 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 hoo." "Oh my," Mom whispered. "We're lucky, Belle. There's a hoot owl living in a tree nearby, keeping an eye on you and me." "Hoo, hoo, 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 hoo." How I wanted to see that owl, but night after night, I only heard him sing his hooty lullaby. Then one night he didn't sing. I waited as the moon rose higher and higher. Suddenly, the owl appeared on a branch nearby. Oh, he was big and wild, that owl, and so near I could almost touch his wings. As I looked in his two wise eyes and he in mine. He stayed with me for a long, long time. I think to say, "I'm glad you're here. I like sharing my home with you." He didn't think I'd ever tell why I draw an owl so well. Until this morning, when the new boy came, I watched his mother wave goodbye from an old blue car that looks like mine. He was about to cry. Such a strange new place. But I thought of my owl and what I could do. "Hi," I said, "my name's Bell." Then I took his hand and showed him where we hang our coats and draw and sing to say, "I'm here. I understand. I'll keep my eye on you." Alfie and Dad. Alfie's dad's name was Simon. On weekdays, he went off to work. But at weekends, he was very good at finding interesting things which they could do together. Alfie and the Flying Lubies.
Alfie and Dad were very good friends. Though Alfie had plenty of other friends, too. His best friend was called Bernard. And then there was Min and Sarah and Daniel, and all the other children who were at nursery school with him. There was Mr. and Mrs. McElneen, who lived across the street, and their daughter, Maureen, who sometimes came to babysit, and his very good friend, the mailman. And there was a new friend who had only just come to live nearby, whose name was Neil. One day, Neil's mom asked Alfie if he would like to come and sleep over at their house. Alfie did not know Neil very well yet, so he thanked her politely and said he would think about it. But perhaps Neil might like to come to us, Mum suggested, and Neil said, yes, please. When the day of the sleepover arrived, Dad moved Annie Rose's cot out of the bedroom she and Alfie shared and into his bedroom and put up a camp bed for Neil. That evening, Neil's mum brought him round with his pajamas and toothbrush in a rucksack and a toy rabbit called Mole. Of course I know that Mole is another sort of animal, he told Alfie, as he laid Mole carefully on the camp bed. But I didn't know that when I first got him, and it just sort of stuck. While Mum was setting Annie Rose off to sleep, Alfie and Neil had supper together. Neil was very good at telling jokes. He made Alfie laugh a lot. At last, after Dad had read them a story, it was bedtime. He came to tuck them both in and left Alfie's little bedside light on. Sleep well, both of you, he whispered as he closed the door. But somehow neither of them was sleepy. They spent a lot of time chatting and giggling. Then Neil scrambled up and lay flat on the floor under his bed. What are you doing? Alfie whispered. I'm just checking whether the flying lubies are here yet, Neil told him. Alfie had never heard of flying lubies, so Neil explained. They nearly always sleep under my bed. I just hope they've been able to find their way here. They're quite small, you see. Alfie wasn't quite sure that he liked the idea of flying lubies. Do they come out and fly around? He asked. No, they drive mostly. They've got their own little cars. And some have bicycles, said Neil as he jumped back into bed. He punched his pillow and settled down with Mole. Don't worry, I expect they'll be here soon, he said. Then he turned over and went to sleep. Alfie lay awake for a long time after Neil had gone to sleep, thinking about the flying lubies and trying to imagine what they looked like. Finally, he crept out of bed and went to fetch Dad. Dad came straight away and knew just what to do. Luckily, Neil was a sound sleeper and didn't wake up when Dad brought a torch and shone it under both beds. There's nothing here, Alfie, he whispered. Don't worry. I expect Neil was just making it up. There are definitely no flying lubies here. At last, Alfie went to sleep. Next morning, when they woke up, Alfie was rather tired. Did the flying lubies come? He asked Neil. I don't think so, Neil answered. Perhaps it was a bit far for them to travel, after all. Secretly, Alfie felt rather relieved that the flying lubies hadn't made it to their house. I don't think Flumbo would like them much, would you, Flumbo? He said, after Neil's mum had come to collect him. And he knew by the look in Flumbo's eye that he was right. Alfie and the Lost Property. One afternoon, Mum and Alfie and Annie Rose were coming home from the shops on the bus. It was very hot and crowded. Annie Rose was tired and cross. She wanted her tea, and so did Alfie. She had Flumbo with him, and Mum had lots of shopping bags. A kind gentleman stood up and gave them his seat, and they all squashed into it together.
Alfie was very glad when they got to their shop. They had just reached the pavement when Alfie realized that he had left Flumbo behind on the bus. He let out a loud cry, but it was too late. "Stop, stop," wailed Alfie. But the bus had already pulled away and was gathering speed in the traffic. Alfie burst into tears. Mum tried to comfort him, but there was nothing they could do but walk home with only the shopping and no Flumbo. "Never mind, Alfie," said Mum. "I'm sure there's some way we can get Flumbo back. We'll ring up the lost property office as soon as we get home." Alfie waited anxiously while Dad made the call. "They say we should go to the main lost property office," he told Alfie when he had finished speaking. "That's the place where all the things people have left on buses are kept until they're claimed. It's too late to go now, but I'll take you there first thing tomorrow morning. It will be quite an adventure." This seemed like a long time to wait. Alfie was so sad to have lost Flumbo that he couldn't get to sleep, even after Dad had tucked him in and read him a story. He took Will's den to bed instead. Willie's den did his best to comfort Alfie, but it wasn't the same as having Flumbo. They had to get him back. Alfie was awake very early the next morning, and as soon as he and Dad had eaten their breakfast, they set out for the lost property office together. And what an amazing place it was! There were hundreds and hundreds of umbrellas and great stacks of briefcases and handbags and more mobile phones than anyone could count. There were some unusual things, too, like a life-size cutout of a man in waiter's uniform, holding up a tray with "Hot Dogs Here" written on him, and an enormous football made of spongy stuff, which was nearly as big as Alfie. "Why would anyone want to take that on a bus?" Dad wondered. They walked past rows of anoraks and many, many different hats and overcoats, until at last they came to a section which said toys. Some of these toys looked as though they had been sitting there for some time, waiting for their owner. "How will we ever find Flumbo?" asked Alfie. "Don't worry," said Dad. "We'll search every shelf until we do." They looked and looked, until suddenly, there, right at the far end, Alfie spotted a familiar knitted arm poking up as though it was waving. "Flumbo!" shouted Alfie. Dad reached up and took him down, and Alfie hugged him tightly. "Hooray!" said Dad. "Now we can go home." But just as they turned away, Alfie caught sight of something that made him stop short. Right at the end of the row, there were three teddies with kind eyes, who each had a label round their neck. Alfie asked Dad what it said. "It says unclaimed," Dad told him. "That means nobody wants them, doesn't it?" said Alfie. When they got home with Flumbo plus three teddies, Mom said, "Well, you did have an adventure, didn't you? This is going to make the toy shelf in your room rather crowded." This was true. Now, Willie's den had to move up to make room for them, but Alfie gave him a special cushion to sit on so he would not be jealous. "Nobody can say that you don't care about your toys, Alfie," Dad said as he kissed him goodnight, with Flumbo safely tucked in beside him. "You didn't much like being in lost property, did you, Flumbo?" Alfie whispered. "But you needn't have worried. We found you in the end, didn't we?" The Lost Cat. Early one morning, Dad and Alfie were in the kitchen, having a chat before Mom and Annie Rose were awake. This was their special time together, just the two of them. They had just given Chessie, the cat, her breakfast, when they heard a scratching noise at the window. When Alfie looked out, he saw a little cat sitting on the windowsill. She was meowing and pawing at the glass, as though she very much wanted to come in. Alfie opened the back door, and right away she jumped down and, before they could stop her, strolled inside. She was a marmalade-colored cat with big green eyes. Chessie stiffened. She crouched down, guarding her food and looking very cross. "Poor little cat, she looks hungry," said Alfie. "Can we give her some milk?" Dad was doubtful. "I don't think we should encourage her," he said. "She probably belongs to someone locally and will find her own way home." And very gently, he picked up the little cat and put her back outside. Alfie made a little bed for her in a box with an old bit of blanket. The little cat got into it, turned around a few times, kneaded it with her paws, then curled up and went to sleep. "I think we should call her Dillies," said Alfie. "We can't keep her," said Dad. "It wouldn't be fair on Chessie. We'll put posters up. If nobody claims her, she'll have to go to the cat's home to find a new family." But things turned out differently. But the little cat wouldn't go away. All day long, she hung about in the back garden. That evening, when it was Alfie's bedtime, he could see her still lurking about in the bushes. Next morning, she was still there, sadly meowing. It was beginning to rain. There was nothing for it but to let her in. A few days later, when Alfie called Dillies for her breakfast, she didn't come. He looked for her everywhere, but she was nowhere to be found. Alfie was very sad. "She must have got lost again," he said. But he needn't have worried, because a few days after that, when he and Dad were walking home down a nearby street, there was Dillies. She was sitting on a wall outside a house. When she saw them, she jumped down and rubbed herself against Alfie's legs, as friendly as could be. While he was stroking her, Dad walked up to the front door of the house and rang the bell. A lady answered. "I'm very sorry to bother you," said Dad. "But is that your cat?" "Yes," the lady said. "That's our Tibbles, all right. May I ask, has she gone missing recently?" "Oh, yes," said the lady. "She disappears regularly, usually for about a week. I think she just likes a change. But we've given up worrying because she always comes back." "Well, we've solved the mystery," said Dad to Alfie as they walked home. "Yes," said Alfie. "We're very good detectives." Dad and Alfie were very pleased that they had found Dillies, or rather Tibbles' real home, but not nearly as pleased as Chessie. She sat on Alfie's lap all evening, purring happily. "I think Dillies is a much better name than Tibbles," said Alfie. "I wonder if she will ever come back and visit us again." But she never did. Okay, I'm going to finish up the first half hour of today's program with Let's Go Swimming with Mr. Silly Pants. Here comes Mr. Silly Pants. He has just signed up for swimming lessons. "Good for me. I'm finally going to learn how to swim. I can't wait. I just hope I don't get water up my nose. What if I go in over my head and sink like a rock? I hope I don't step on a fish. What if all the other people in the class are better than I am? I think I'll have a sandwich. Let's see. Tomatoes, lettuce, olives, cheese, pickles, tuna, peanut butter, mayonnaise, salami, cheese, pickles, olives, lettuce, and mustard. A perfect sandwich. What if somebody dunks me? I hate being dunked. Maybe this isn't such a good idea after all. I'm not going. I hope I'm not being silly about this. Oh, what a nice dream. I must be on the desert. The sand is really hot on my feet, and I'm very thirsty. Something tells me to go this way. My, what a beautiful view. It reminds me of New Hampshire.
Sure. Oh, he's dropping off a cliff. Oh, no. Water, I can't swim. Now he's in the water. Oh, and he's surrounded by fish. Oh, I've got to get out of here. Oh, oh, look, sandwiches with dill pickles. I'm hungry. Help, help, give me strength. Help, help, help. Grr, and then there's a shark. Ring, 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 ring. Excuse me, do you folks have a telephone down here? I don't think so. I don't think so. These are the fish. I don't think so. No, I don't think so. Nope, nope, I don't think so. Wait a minute. It's not a phone. It's... And something's ringing. 7:30. Time for my swimming lesson. It's his clock. Well, silly pants, I think everything's going to be all right. And it was. And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading the novel that I've been reading now for about 3 months, titled The Ballad of Darcy and Russell. Darcy believes in love at first sight. She spent her whole life waiting for that perfect, magical moment. But right now, her life is anything but perfect. After a music festival, she's stranded at a bus station until morning, the day before she leaves for college. Her phone is dead, she has no cash, and she's convinced nothing good can come of this night. But then she meets Russell. Russell, cute and nice, funny and kind. This is the moment and the guy she's been waiting for. And they have until sunrise to walk and talk and connect. Over the course of this one fateful night, filled with football field picnics, night swimming, and escape artist dogs, Darcy and Russell's lives will change forever. They'll discover things they never imagined about each other and about themselves. But can you really know someone after only a handful of hours? Is it possible to fall in love in just one day? And is it worth saying hello when you know you're destined for a goodbye? Okay, last week, they got caught in the swimming pool, swimming in the hotel pool. And in the hotel lobby, Russell pulled out his phone, which Darcy assumed had been dead all this time. He also wasn't wearing a bracelet that all the festival goers had to wear. He called his dad, who happens to be Wiley Sanders. He's the lead singer for Darcy's favorite band, the Nighthawks. So now sitting in Wiley Sanders' helicopter, they're now flying back to Vegas. Darcy is angry with Russell for lying to her and not saying anything after she said her dad and her love the band Nighthawks. They've just landed in Vegas, and Darcy is considering returning to the bus station. And that's where I left off last week. I just wanted to go home. I wanted to curl up in my bed and pull the covers over me and let this all become a bad dream. I wanted to be back in a place where things made sense, where my life was quiet and boring again, where I wasn't in the middle of nowhere in Nevada, trying to grapple with feelings that kept hitting me in waves, like I was caught in the ocean, unable to swim past the breakers. Wait, Russell had called, running out of the hotel after me, his voice raw. Darcy! What? I wheeled around on him, my voice catching in my throat. What can you possibly... My dad's lawyers. He held out his phone to me. They need to talk to you. Oh, I took the phone from him. Nothing that it was almost completely charged. And had a brief conversation with a paralegal named Sarah, who seemed remarkably awake and focused, given that it was getting late on a Sunday night. She told me that someone named CJ would need just a smidge of my time when we got to the compound. Then she'd hung up, and I handed Russell his phone back. CJ, I said, folding my arms over my chest, apparently needs to circle up with us when we get to the compound. Ah, yeah, Russell said. He ran his hands through his hair. It was drying funny.
sticking up in places, and only 20 minutes ago, I would have found it beyond enduring. They want to talk to us, make sure everyone is clear on details in case the Silver Standard decides to press charges. I nodded, even though just hearing press charges was enough to make me feel wobbly. Instead, I focused on the other part of my conversation with Sarah. "What's the compound?" Russell sighed and looked at the ground. We were standing outside the front doors of the Silver Standard, the same place where, not that long ago, he'd kissed me as easily as anything. And now everything was broken into pieces all around us. It's my dad's place in Vegas. He got it when he started his residency there. It's outside of town, half an hour from the Strip. And they expect me to go there? My dad, Russell started, then shook his head. He's sending a helicopter for us. His voice was small. The automatic doors opened and stayed that way for a hopeful beat before sliding closed again. When this happened a second time, I realized we must be in front of the sensor and walked to the side. "I'm not going anywhere with you." Russell took a step back, looking like I'd slapped him. "Darcy, you lied to me." I didn't know I was going to yell this until I was already doing it. "You told me your phone was dead, that your name was Russell Henrion." I stopped suddenly, realizing what I just heard. "Did you say helicopter?" So even though I hadn't wanted to be there, I also didn't want to have charges pressed against me for trespassing. I figured I would go talk to CJ, charge my phone, and then head to the bus station in Las Vegas. I still had my ticket and might even be able to get back to LA sooner now. And if not, I'd just wait there until I could get the first bus home. I had been planning on waiting all night at the bus station in Jesse after all, so it's not like it made much difference. I knew it wasn't a great plan, but it was all I had, and I was clinging to it tight. When the helicopter arrived, it touched down near the abandoned gas station. Perhaps not surprisingly, the Jesse, Nevada bus station was not outfitted with a helipad. I'd gone back in to get my things, and they were right where I'd left them, under the bench. As I looked around, it felt like years, not just hours, had passed since I'd been there. Too much had changed for everything in it to look exactly the same, for the vending machine light to still be flickering on and off. The couple who'd been watching the movie were asleep, curled up together under an unzipped sleeping bag. Sunburned, bald man was still sleeping, and as I looked at him, I realized that he'd had the right idea all along. I should have followed his lead, just conked out on one of the benches and waited out my time until morning. I shouldn't have ventured beyond my comfort zone. I should have just stayed put. "But you had fun," Katie whispered. I hadn't wanted to think about that, so I just grabbed the tent and my duffel and went outside to wait for the helicopter. The pilot, Scott, had been cheerful and unfazed, like he was just always picking up teenagers in the middle of nowhere, late at night. And who knows, maybe he was. If anything had become clear to me in the last half hour, it was that I didn't know Russell at all. Scott had told us how to duck our heads to avoid the propellers, and once we were on board, had made sure we were buckled in. He explained about the headphones and that we should be landing in 20 minutes. Quite an upgrade for someone who couldn't afford an Uber, Dee Dee had pointed out. And in regular circumstances, I would have been really excited to ride in a helicopter for the first time. especially this helicopter. The seats were soft, dark blue leather with a WS monogram stitched into all of them. But I just sat up straight with my legs twined around each other, trying to take up as little space as I could, staring out the window and willing us to land as soon as possible. I felt someone tap my knee and looked over to see Russell trying to get my attention, saying something I couldn't hear. All at once, I flashed back to the pool, to his hands on my bare skin, my fingers running over the ridges of his abs, the feel of him pressing against me as we kissed. I felt my face flood with heat, remembering what we'd done, what I'd said. I'd told him that I was a virgin. I told him I'd been waiting for him. I told him about not getting into anywhere except two schools. I'd even told him about my brisket food poisoning. I'd opened myself up to him and shown him my whole heart, assuming all the while he was doing the same, never dreaming that he was hiding things from me, that he had his own agenda. How could I have been so stupid? Well, Dee Dee started. You weren't stupid, Katie interrupted. You were just taking a chance. Russell tapped his headphones again, and I finally turned them on. What? Darcy, listen, he said in a rush. It was disconcerting to hear him like that right in my ear. I'm really sorry. I shouldn't have lied to you. I know that. Was it all just a game to you? I wanted to sound tough and cool, but this failed spectacularly, and my voice started to shake, three words in. Were you trying to trick me? No, Russell closed his eyes for a moment. I just wanted to be me for once. Not Wiley Sanders' kid. Not someone with all that baggage. I've never just gotten to be anonymous before tonight. But you weren't anonymous. I hugged my arms because I was cold and because it felt like I was slowly coming apart. You told me your name was Russell Henrion and that your dad was a structural engineer. Well, it's a family name, he said quietly, and I know I didn't tell you about my dad, but what? That's not a little detail you forgot to mention. It's not like my dad's in advertising and instead I told you he's in marketing. What your dad does is a big fucking deal. Yes, Russell said, pointing at me. Exactly. That's just what I'm talking about. The second anyone knows, it changes everything. And I hate it. It's been my whole life. Everyone having ideas about who I am before they've even met me. I never know how they actually feel about me. He took a shaky breath. I mean, you had my dad's face on your sweatshirt. You were telling me what a big fan you are. He's inescapable. It's like this shadow I've never been able to get out of. And tonight, I thought, I guess I just wanted to see if you actually liked me. Well, at some point, I think that was clear, I said. I was going to sleep with you. Guys, you just jumping in here, Scott the pilot said, sounding uncomfortable. Wanted to let you know I'm also on this channel and can hear this whole conversation. I'm switching to channel 2. We should be landing in 10 minutes. Thanks, Scott, Russell said faintly. Thank you, I echoed, wondering if maybe tonight was some kind of simulation just to see how much mortification one human being could take before they literally explode or went mad. I was going to tell you, Russell said after a moment. When? Well, in the pool, right before the security guard showed up. Oh, that's very convenient. It's true. But I can't believe anything you're telling me, I yelled, and I felt tears prick my eyes. Something in his face crumpled, and he looked out the window. I hated that he still looked so cute, that the sight of his inside-out T-shirt was making my heart hurt. I hated that I'd opened myself up to him, only to be slapped back down again. "I don't understand about the phone," I said after a few moments of silence. "Why did you tell me that your phone was also dead when it was working?" Russell looked over at me, then down at the sneakers, one of which I saw now was untied. "I just," he said, mostly to his shoes, "I thought that maybe if we were in the same situation, we could just hang out. I never expected anything like what we had, Darcy. And then you were so great, and we were having so much fun, and I shouldn't have done it," he said quietly, "and I'm sorry." We banked slightly to the right, and suddenly, there they were, the lights of Las Vegas. I'd been once before when my dad had a conference when I was 8. Mostly what I remembered was riding the roller coaster at New York, New York, and the circus-themed hotel we'd stayed at. But I'd never seen it like this from the air, the sudden, dazzling brightness of it. We flew past the city, the lights dimming behind us. Darcy? I looked over at Russell, who was twisting his hands together. "Couldn't it be like the ship of Theseus? Just like we talked about? The essence stays the same, right? You know something new about me, but the me you met is still the same. Could you maybe think of it like that?" For half a second, I hesitated. Maybe, if I squinted, I could somehow return to the movie I'd been pretending we were in. But a moment later, I came back to reality. The bubble we were in had burst. I was awake now and finally seeing things clearly. "No," I said, and his face fell. "I was totally open with you, completely honest, and..." "Really," he said. He didn't phrase it like a question. "You don't seem to want to talk about Stanwyck or why you're going there. You keep changing the subject. Why?" I drew back against the seat. "That's my business," I said hotly. "Maybe I don't want to talk about everything." "And there it is," Russell said, pointing at me. "You can be mad at me if you want. I deserve it. But don't pretend that you were some open book tonight." I knew that what he was saying was true, which just made me even more irritated. "Fine," I said, shaking my head. "Whatever. But we can just drop this, okay? There's no point." "What? What do you mean?" "I mean, I'll talk to the lawyer because I don't want to get arrested. But then I'm leaving." "Where are you going?" "Well, I'll go to the bus station in Vegas and get back home." "You can't just leave. We have to..." "What?" I snapped. I wished we weren't still talking about this. It was hard for me to hold on to just how hurt and betrayed I'd felt when he was looking across at me earnestly, his eyebrows drawn together. But he had lied to me and manipulated me. I'd been vulnerable with him and had gotten practically naked with him. And he had a heartbeat away from sleeping with him. And the whole time, he had been keeping things from me. I couldn't let those facts slip away, no matter how regretful he suddenly seemed now. "Why are we even doing this? What's the point?" The point is, we like each other, right?" I felt something in my resolve start to crack, and I tried to ignore it. The "who cares, Darcy" of an hour ago was gone. If Russell still thought we were in a story where everything was fated, meant to be, and all worked out in the end, well, that was a him problem. "This," I said, gesturing between us, "is done. We don't need to keep..."
I shook my head. I'll talk to this lawyer, and then I'll be out of your hair, and we can just pretend this never happened. But I don't want to do that. Well, I do. Russell took a breath, like he was going to say something, but then just sat back against his seat, his dad's initials emblazoned above his head. He was looking at me like he'd never seen me before, like he didn't know me, which wasn't inaccurate. I'd only known him for a handful of hours, after all. If you were presenting a selective version of yourself, Katie pointed out, isn't that what you're getting mad at him for? Wow. What? It's just really that black and white with you. All or nothing? I wrapped my arms around myself, not loving that he'd pinpointed what Dee Dee and Katie and my dad were always saying. I took a breath to respond just as a helicopter seemed to stop. We hovered in the air for a moment, then started to descend. We touched down, the noise in the cabin lessened, and when Russell took his headphones off, I took mine off too. I ran my hand through my still, pool-damp hair, but I knew it was probably a lost cause. I leaned out the window to try to see where we were just as Scott, the pilot, opened the door and motioned us out. Russell gestured for me to leave first. This would have charmed me an hour ago, but now it just made me roll my eyes. I ducked my head as I stepped off and walked out, even though it seemed like the propeller blades were slowing way down. When I cleared the helicopter, I straightened up and looked around. We had landed on the top of a building, even though it only seemed like it was one or two stories. I could see that there was a WS pointed in the center of a circle on the helipad in the same font as had been stitched into the seats. WS for Wiley Sanders. I had just arrived at a rock star's house, and my determination to be unfazed by any of this went out the window as I looked around and was immediately fazed. As I tried to take it all in, not easy, I understood why Sarah, the paralegal, had called this a compound, because house really wouldn't have been enough to fit all that was in front of me. There was a second building, a ways away from the building I was currently standing on top of, and this seemed to be the main structure. It was an enormous, sprawling mansion, two stories, all glass and weathered wood. There was a huge pool, and the entire property was ringed with palm trees. It looked like most of the lights in the main building were on. The light spilling out onto the massive lawn that I had just hoped was artificial grass. Because Vegas. Behind the main house were a series of smaller structures that looked like they had been constructed to resemble many versions of the bigger house. I had no idea what they were, but there were five of them. Guest houses? I was just gobsmacked by the scale of it all. Our whole house in Raven Rock probably could have fit into this helipad, with room to spare. Hello? I turned around and saw two people standing just off the helipad. One guy, one girl, both in their 20s. They were both wearing khakis and half-zip black pullovers that had WS stitched on them in the same font from the helicopter and helipad. Hey, Rusty, the guy said to Russell as the girl gave me a nod and walked around to the back of the helicopter. Welcome home. Hi, Kendrick, Russell said, giving him a smile. But I could see that Rusty had annoyed him. But then, a second later, this annoyed me. I barely knew this guy. How was I intuiting what his unspoken feelings were? He gestured to me. This is Darcy. Darcy Milligan, the guy, Kendrick, said, giving me a crisp nod. We got the full download from Bronwyn. Nice to meet you. Bronwyn? Yeah, my dad's publicist. It looked like it pained Russell to say each of these words. This is Kendrick. That's Bella. He gestured to the girl who is now emerging from the other side of the helicopter, carrying my tent and duffel bag. She gave me a wave with her free hand. No, I said, taking a step closer to her. I can't get that. No worries, she said cheerfully, not stopping. I'll just bring them into the main residence for you while you guys meet with CJ in SNF. Yes, Kendrick said, lifting up an iPad and scrolling through it. CJ's en route now, shall we? I looked for Belle, who had already disappeared. I didn't like that my stuff was suddenly gone. But what was I supposed to do about it? Great, Kendrick said, as though I'd just agreed with him. He typed something on his iPad, then nodded at us and walked toward a door at the far end of the helipad. I followed him. It turned out the door wasn't a door, but an elevator. And we all stepped inside to go down one floor. I looked at Russell as we descended. He was staring resolutely at the floor, like he was trying to pretend none of this was happening. My head was spinning as I tried to take it all in. The fact that Russell had grown up with this stuff, with staff with iPads escorting you around helicopters and main residences and publicists. I couldn't even fathom it. The doors opened and we stepped out. It seemed like we had walked into an office building. There was a lobby-type area with couches and a coffee table, and then offices behind glass doors running down the hallway. And unfortunately, this is where I'm going to have to stop today because we are out of time. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the novel, The Ballad of Darcy and Russell. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.